I guess you think of your leaves, you think of the fun times more than you think of the sort of grim times. Some of the things we did in the grim times, one wonders, you know, you don't really talk about them because people don't always understand them, you know. I think blowing myself up in Holland was the dumbest thing I ever did in the whole bloody war. Yet there was no way of knowing that they were going to kick the goddamn thing down the stairs. First leaving Rome, tremendous experience. I don't think I drew a sober breath for 7 days. And I got back up the line after this was over. First of all, the road was washed out, so we had to go all the way south and back up through Avellino and everything on the eastern shore. And I had this terrible hangover. God, I couldn't even hold water down in my stomach. When I got back up the line, I checked into battalion headquarters and I went up to my platoon. And we were in a place called Bagnacavallo at the time, on the reverse slope of the Sanio dike banks. And I checked in with my platoon sergeant, and he took one look at me. He said, "Christ, you were supposed to be on leave and getting a rest." He said, "You look awful." And I allowed to saw that was probably true. I said, "Is everything okay?" I checked the platoon. And then I climbed into the slit trench and wrapped myself up in my gas cape. That's what we used to use instead of a blanket. And went to sleep. And when I woke, I could smell a stench of cordite, the whole works. I had slept through the worst shelling and mortaring that they'd had for about 2 weeks. And I could hear Guthrie, my platoon sergeant, calling out, make sure everybody was all right. And he sort of jumped into my slit trench and I said, "What the hell's been happening?" He said, "You just slept through the worst goddamn shelling." I said, "When you wake me up?" He said, "That shelling wouldn't wake you up. Nothing would wake you up." You know, so that was an entertaining experience. First time I'd ever gone to sleep through all this thing when my platoon might have been at some risk, except, of course, I had the best platoon sergeant in the battalion, who would not have let anything go adrift. There was, I think, even in action, of course, there's some fun. I can remember on the Savio River, a couple of Germans in staff cars, German officers, one of them was a paymaster, coming forward to pay the troops when we hit them. And I can remember Corporal Owen shouting at the top of his lungs, "Watch that guy, don't shoot him in the binoculars." They're mine, so they shot the guy, all right, but Owen's got the binoculars. And we collected enough German money to give everybody in my platoon got about $100.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't, the German occupational money was used by everybody, as was our occupational money, because if you'd all of a sudden said you can't use the German occupation money, it would put Italy's economy in even a worse state, you see. So by the time we'd sort of sorted out all the money, we did a little looting that day. Then I had a guy in my platoon, Cooper, and he always referred to the Germans as prisoners of war. Fine if you remembered that that's what he was referring to. But I can remember in the middle of a battle at Wurst in Holland, Cooper saying, "Sir, there's 5 prisoners of war over there." And I forgot, in the middle of everything, we were having a hard time. I said, "Well, Christ, don't just let them sit there, run them back." And he sort of looked at me kind of strangely and took off. And he did, but he only ran 2 of them back, killed 3 of them. I said, "I thought you said they were prisoners of war." He said, "Well, they are now." So we had those kinds of fellas. He used to drive my company commander nuts. We would start off up the line, everybody with their tin hats on and everything. And as soon as we crossed the start line, Cooper's tin hat would be hung on his belt someplace. And he had an old opera hat that he'd looted someplace in Italy. And, you know, that flattened down. And he'd get it all up and he'd put his opera hat on and he was in business. That was his battle bonnet. Yeah. I can see him now saying, "Christ, there's some PWs over there. Well, let's let them lie there, Cooper. Go and get them." "Yes, sir." And off he went. And I dispatched this guy all by his little lonesome to bring in 5 Germans that I thought had already had their hands hawked. And They haven't. The next thing I know, I can hear grenade going and rifle going and one thing and another, and he runs two of them back, and there's three of them lying on the greensward. And I said, I thought you said they were prisoners of war. He said, well, they are, what's left of them. He was quite an interesting guy. I haven't seen him since the war. I'd like to see him again. I liked him. In fact, I liked them all. I had some fine, fine soldiers, brave men. We had quite a few people at the end from Nova Scotia. They had come out as reinforcements to the West Nova Scotia Regiment, but we needed the reinforcements better, and they got posted into the Edmonton Regiment, and they stayed with us till the end of the war. And hence, we get some, every now and then, some of these guys come out and visit us from, at our affairs from Nova Scotia, you know. A lot of them have done well in peacetime, and they can afford to travel and that kind of thing. So, they were really great. The NCOs were good. You know, you can't fight any war anywhere unless you have first-class non-commissioned officers. Because once battle is joined, to use the field marshal's expression, officers are leading. That's their job. You know, it really doesn't matter whether you got a hell of a lot of clues, as long as you're prepared to walk along in front of your troops. And you've issued the orders, and you have to depend on your non-commissioned officers to get the job done. And you have to be leader enough to be able to say, follow me, and then not look to see if they're coming. And I guess probably the hallmark of whether you can do it or whether you can't do it is whether they come or whether they don't come. And I was always very fortunate. I guess they thought I was so young they couldn't let me go by myself, and that I needed to be pampered. But I never, ever remember ever saying, let's go, or follow me, and ever having to worry about whether they were coming or not. To the worst of the shelling, to the worst of the machine gun fire, to the Hitler line, these brave, brave men, and they're young. You got to bear in mind that wars are not fought by the fellows in the labor unions, and they're not fought in the main by middle class, not in the infantry. These are kids. They're schoolboys, and they're the aristocracy. The people who feel that they've got a stake in the country and go. So there is this wide gap between the schoolboys and the aristocracy and the rest of the people. If they are in the service, they may wear the same ribbons, but there is no way you can compare a war conducted by somebody in the Ordnance Corps or REME with war as conducted by an infantryman. The other thing to remember is that in those days, the closer you got to the front, the less money you got for it. No infantryman got Group 4 trades pay like a craftsman in REME, for instance. But it was the infantrymen. When you read the casualty list, they're infantry soldiers, the odd gunner, and they're armored corps soldiers, and the odd engineer. But they aren't in the main service corps, ordnance corps, REME, that kind of thing. They just, you know, I'm not running those corps down, but what I'm saying is it is a different war for an infantryman. And when you walk through a cemetery, as I did in 1980 in Grosbeak, the number of kids, 15, 16, 17, 18. Now, the Army thought they were older. The Army were purposely sending boys there, although we all knew they were kids. It was after the war when their parents declared their right age, and their right age was put on the tombstone. It is just amazing how young they were. Sort of say, Jesus, was I ever that young, you know. So that it's, war is seen from an infantry soldier is really a different kettle of fish than war is seen by anybody else. And it's day after day, and it's lying in the trenches, it's lying in the mud. And the only thing that holds you together is the sort of regimental esprit de corps, the desire not to let your comrades down. It is worse. Everybody's afraid. Only the fools are not afraid. They don't last long, and they're poor leaders, generally. The trick is to be afraid and be able to control it. And so if you can do that, you can get on with it. You do stupid little things. On the Naviglio Canal, I did a couple of stupid things. My best friend, Keith McGregor, and I had to cross that canal something like a minute apart, and he was first over the dike bank. Eh? But he's got his whole platoon lined up over the dike bank. And he's crossing it, and he's going to go to the left, and that one axis, and then I cross it and go straight ahead, so we're even pretty well, okay, going forward, the two forward turns. So I got my people back of the dike in these sort of buildings, trying to stay out of the shell fire and machine gun and that kind of thing. And Keith gets up on the dike, and he's got his whole platoon lined up on the dike bank, and he stands up on top of the dike bank, and he said, "I saw this in a war movie once," and he whips out his whistle and blows it. It's a very distinctive sound, a whistle on the battlefield. Waves his hand, just like World War I, eh? And all his platoon went over the dike bank with no hassle. Off they went, see? And then I hustle my platoon forward to the dike bank, and I think, great, that's a good idea. I think I'll do the same thing. So I get my platoon all lined up. I'm watching my watch, and I think, and I reach in to get my whistle, and I haul out my lanyard, and guess to my shock surprise, I don't have a whistle attached to it. What I do have is a bottle opener attached to it. And I can hear old Sergeant Guthrie say, "Ah, shit, let's go." And off we went. Gosh, there I was, standing up there mid-shot and shell, all set to blow a whistle like my friend McGregor had. And when I hauled my lanyard out, there wasn't a whistle attached to it. There was a bottle opener attached.
Yeah, those are the sorts of things. 2 days later on that St. Bridgehead, I caught a bullet in the arm, and that was doing something stunned too. Anyway, those are the sorts of things that sort of stick in your memory. We still laugh about them. Everybody, of course, gives me a bad time at all regimental reunions for blowing myself up with my own grenade, including the lieutenant governor of this province, as a matter of fact, who at one time in his distinguished military career had the good fortune to command the Edmonton Regiment. Yeah.
How did you end up blowing yourself up with your own grenade?
Well, we were attacking, this was in Holland, uh-huh, about 2 weeks before the end of the war, April the 24th, to be precise. At that time, the main name of the game was to push the Germans back, but gently, so that they wouldn't retaliate on the Dutch cities where people were dying of starvation. So we were closing the no man's land sort of slowly, giving the Germans plenty of time to withdraw without, you know, I mean, nobody wants to be the last dead man in a war. And we were moving up to a line called the Greb Line, which fronted Amersfoort and northwest Holland. And we were doing this company attack, standard company attack, two platoons forward, and one in reserve, company headquarters in the center. And I was still in C Company and still commanding 14th Platoon. And we headed off to take out these two farm buildings. And again, a standard, I had a section on my left in extended order and a section on my right in extended order with me in the center of the two sections. And behind me, platoon headquarters of Sergeant Guthrie and his merry band of pirates, and the reserve section behind him. And as we got to these two farm buildings, I dispatched the left-hand section to take out the building on the left. And I went with Bill Hinckley, Corporal Hinckley, to take out the building on the right. And as we got to the building on the right, I looked up, and there in the second-story window, I could see a German, uniform and all, and they were sort of, I guess, ready for business. And I decided that the thing to do was to throw a grenade in the upstairs window. And while it blew upstairs, taking out, hopefully, the Germans upstairs, we would come in the bottom of the building. Now, the normal technique as you become an experienced infantryman is to take your grenade, pull the pin, let the striker lever fly off and count two, and then throw it. And then if they pick it up to throw it back to you, they can share it amongst them, you see? But because I was outside the building and they were inside the building, I threw it according to the book. 5 second fuse, and I heaved a grenade, and it went right through the window, just like Joe DiMaggio cutting a runner off at the plate. And as it crashed through the window, I headed for the door with Corporal Hinckley in his section in hot pursuit. And to kick open the door, I kicked open the door to move to the far side to sort of start working the place over with my stun gun. And there, bouncing down a staircase, is my grenade. They simply kicked it downstairs. And, of course, I say to myself, shit, this is no place for Mrs. Dudley's little boy, Bob. And I start hitting the deck, but it all blows up in my face. And I get 23 holes. I get And then things are in slow motion. Funny, I can remember this all in detail. Things are in slow motion. I'm lying on the floor, and my stun gun's long gone. And I've been hitting in the wrist here, and I've been hitting the face, both legs. And I'm trying to get my pistol out, because there's a German at the top of the staircase, and he's got a Schmeisser. And I figure he's going to try and write me off. And I'm sort of lying face down, sort of, or on my side, and I'm fumbling around with my left hand, and I'd have shot myself in the foot, probably, if I'd got my pistol out. And if he had fired the Schmeisser the way he'd at one time been trained to fire it, instead of aiming it and all that horseshit, he'd have got me. But the next guy through the door was Bill Hinckley, you see. And funny the things you think about. All of this, of course, is happening in split seconds, I guess. But they seemed like they were happening in slow motion. And I thought to myself, how terribly undignified. Here I am lying here, and there I can see Bill Hinckley's khaki-clad battle-dressed legs on either side of me, and he blows this German away at the top of the stairs, you see. And I think to myself, how undignified. I can feel the hot injections from the shell, the spent casings, hitting my ass, you know, as Bill shoots these guys. And we left three dead in the place, and we took 10 prisoners. And then the whole thing became an exercise in total futility. But I got evacuated, and as I say, that sort of ended the war. But that's how it happened. Well, there's been all sorts of stories about it, and every now and then, it's always brought up at every regimental reunion. Always, you know, good old Dudley blew himself up with his own grenade. I think I was the last officer wounded in the battalion. Mm-hmm. Not something that I really that I'm bragging about, you know, kind of too. Things went from bad to worse, though. Do you want to hear the story of the evacuation? It's terribly funny,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
anyway,
sure.
Well, to start with, we don't have a stretcher readily available. I'm lying there on the deck. The two houses have been cleaned, and the position's being consolidated. And Sergeant Guthrie is standing over me. And I present him with the bottle of scotch that's in my small pack. And I give him my bloodstained maps and everything. And they find the ladder. And they put me on this ladder to take me out, you see. I've got a lance corporal who runs PIA, the projector infantry anti-tank in the platoon. A fellow by the name of Dick, who speaks perfect German. He's a big bugger. He's about 6'2 or something. Huge bugger. Tough muscles for a guy where nobody should have muscles. Anyway, we got these German PWs. What we've crossed to get there is purported to get to this target is purported to be a minefield. But I haven't told the platoon. You don't tell a platoon a thing like that. They're busy looking for mines and they get shot in the head, you see. So it could have been a phony and it could have been a real one. Anyway, I all of a sudden had to cross it again, only this time on a stretcher. Well, they've taken me into the house on the left. And there's a Dutch family, a dear lady who I thought was as old as Methuselah, was probably about 35 or thereabouts, but to me that was old. And she's washing the blood off my face and weeping and all that crap. My CO comes over, the colonel of the regiment comes over, and says, "What are you trying to do, get a pension?" I was delighted to tell him that I eventually did, but anyway, that's another story. Anyway, there's all these Germans, you see. And by this time I've had a short shot of morphine, and I've already had a belt of rum from Bill Hinckley's rum bottle. So, there I am on the ladder, and we set four Germans out in front in sort of arrowhead, eh? And we got six Germans carrying this ladder with me aboard it, doped up with morphine, rum, and my pistol in my hand. And I said to Corporal Dick, I say, "Tell these guys they're taking me back across the minefield to where the stretcher jeeps are, and that if they so much as jar me, I'm going to start shooting. I'll shoot every one of them." And here's old Dick, and he's telling them in German like you wouldn't believe, you know. And they're all going act tongue, the whole business. And so I get lugged across this ersatz minefield with these guys, you see. And they get me back to where the jeeps are, and I get taken to the regimental aid post. And our MO is there, Ken Maxwell. I guess it's Bob Levine at that time. Anyway, they put me in and they lay me on a table in the regimental aid post. And old Levine looks at me and says, "Christ, you look awful." I said, "You're not supposed to say something like that to a wounded soldier. You're supposed to commiserate with me." It looked terrible. He says, "However, you don't seem to be hitting the guts or anything. You want a drink?" And I said, "Yeah." You know those little Coca-Cola glasses? He pours one full of rum, eh? And this is rum like you don't buy in the garage shop. This is special rum Demerara, eh? So he pours this thing full of rum. And I knock it back just as if it's Coke. That tastes pretty good, so I said, "I'll have another." And he gives me another belt. And he sort of takes a look at the shell dressings and everything. He says, "Well, they ought to hold you till you get the FSU, the field surgical unit." So they put me on a stretcher jeep and they take me down to the field surgical unit. Stretcher driven by Lance Corporal Bohemia, who, MM, super soldier too. And I pass out on the stretcher. Got nothing to do with the wound. I'm drunk, you know. And I've had the best part of half a bottle of rum on top of the Serrata of morphine that my company stretcher bearer slammed into me right after the wounding. And I know that they're taking the jeep off the stretcher off the jeep and passing it through a window because I can hear the sash go up, you see. And the next thing I know, I'm in some sort of operating theater because I can feel the hot lights on my feet. And I hear the MO say, "Well, let's get these shell dressings off and have a look at his legs. They seem to be the worst." I got shell dressings on my leg. I've been hit here and here. I'm a mess. And I open my eyes and I can't see anything. So I announce in a loud, clear voice, "Leave the legs for a bit. I got both eyes open and I can't see anything." If you wear glasses, you're sort of, they've been blowing off, of course. You know what the MO says, "Okay, we'll have a look at your eyes." Then I hear him sort of chuckling. I'm drunk, you see, and I'm saying, "Well, I don't think this is very funny." And what's happened is that when I passed out, my eyes had closed, and the blood had come from here and around my face, and it got in my eyelashes, and it had congealed. And when I thought I had my eyes open, of course, they were closed tight, you see. A little warm, soapy water, and I could see again, you see. And as soon as I popped my baby blues at him, he took one look at me, he said, "Jesus," looked at my... They put a little tag and an envelope on you with all your regimental particulars. He said, "Dudley, my God, you were through my field surgical unit in Italy last December." "Yes, I was. Had a bullet in the arm." "Or been punched up with a bullet." "A couple of bullet burns across your chest." "Yes, sir." "You were drunk then, and you're drunk again." Well, actually, you know, that's one of the things that they do. They give you a couple of belts of rum to sort of ward off shock and one thing or another. He said, "What the hell's Levine doing up at the unit?" He said, "You're about the 7th Edmonton Regiment casualty through here today, and you've all been smashed." So that was the beginning. I then got transported down the line. They took me from the field surgical unit to Nijmegen, where they put me on a hospital train. And from Nijmegen, we went to Ghent to the 29th British General Hospital. That's where they operated on me and took out most of the shrapnel. And I came out of that, and they then air-evac'd me to England. And I was in hospital when VE Day rolled around. Shortly after VE Day, well, 2 or 3 days after VE Day, I'm lying in the hospital, and this has got to be a scene that I think is tremendous. It's one of the funnier things that happened to me during the war. I'm lying there in the hospital, and I have a plaster of Paris cast from my right hip down, well, just below my right hip, from the top of my right leg to my right ankle on one side. And I got elastic bandages with shell dressings and everything from the top of my left leg to my ankle. I've got this arm in a sling of some sort. I can't see because they can't sit me up to test my eyes, so I can't read anything or anything. I get patches all over my face and everything. I'm lying there in the hospital. And along comes a medical officer who's only a lieutenant, which indicates to me he's been in the Army about 2 months or something. And he's marching around and he stops at my bed and he says, "Mr. Dudley," and I allow him to sound, that's who I am, that's what it says on the bed. He said, "My instructions are to ask you if you wish to volunteer for service in the Pacific Theater of Operations." Because they were asking everybody to re-volunteer with a crock. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. And I burst out laughing. I couldn't believe it. I said, "Christ, we are in bad shape. Here I am lying here with bandages and plaster of Paris, can't even walk. Haven't got any glasses, so I can't see anything. On top of that, it's my right arm that's buggered up. I couldn't even sign it. And I said, gee, we got to be in bad shape if the only reinforcements you can find are used up old buggers like me. And he looked at me and said, I'll help you sign. And he did. There I lay in the hospital bed, signing my volunteer papers to go to the Pacific Theater, with him helping me write R.W. Dudley on there. Yeah, right? There was a guy in the bed next to me, from the Black Watch. Subler from the Black Watch. And he was just incensed at this. He was a lot older than me. And he was married, and he had a couple of kids home, and he wanted to get home. Me, I wasn't married, and I viewed myself as a professional, and I wanted to stay in the Army, so there was no rush to go anywhere. And I thought that if I volunteered for the Pacific, that'll give me some brownie points when they come to making your mind up about who stays and who doesn't stay in the Army. And so anyway, he was really upset. He was busy telling this medical officer in no uncertain terms, how are you talking? Kept calling me a kid, and I'd been at the front three times as long as he had. But I didn't make any fuss about it. In those days, I was kind of gentle. Anyway, that was another funny thing that I thought was terribly funny. Anyway, in due course, I went home on a Pacific draft, and I was in pretty good shape compared to some of the guys. Christ, there were guys going up the gangplank in crutches. Can you imagine being returned to Canada for onward transmission to the Pacific? Division, the Canadian Army. Yeah, what a disaster. So it took me another 6 years to get to the Pacific when we went to Korea. But the Pacific exercise, of course, pulled it before that division could get into action. So. Or before I could join it, for that matter, although I was about to be promoted and made second in command of, again, C Company in the Edmonton Regiment. But it all folded and then there was the usual running around from pillar to post, one peacetime station after another, until the Korean thing and off to Korea. Well, there's the war, according to Bob Dudley.
Uh-huh. So what were you doing you lived in Vancouver now after you came back?
No. I never got back to Vancouver after World War II, except as on a visit. There were the usual postings in between 45, the September 45, when the war finally folded for good,
mm-hmm.
and October 46, when they established who was staying in the service and who wasn't. And during that period of time, I was stationed in two or three places that were sort of reallocation depots. They were people getting out, people staying in, and, you know, there was all mostly administration. I was in Simcoe in Ontario, one of these things, and Wetaskiwin in Alberta. I spent a couple of months guarding Jerry prisoners of war at Medicine Hat. Then finally wound up at the School of Infantry teaching the mortar. And I stayed at the School of Infantry until about July of 46, I guess. And I was posted to St. John, New Brunswick, where I was the administrative and training officer for a militia unit. Still in the Army full-time, but each unit had one of these AMT officers. And I was posted to New Brunswick Cottage. Quite like that. I had a great time in New Brunswick. And then after 46 rolled along, and I spent 46 there and most of 47. And in the early part of 48, I was dispatched to the airborne school and got my parachute wings. And then back to the School of Infantry, and then to the PPCLI. And I rejoined the PPCLI in 48. been there about 2 months and was posted back to Rivers to command the airborne platoon of the Patricias. We had a special air service company.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for about 4 or 5 months. And then it was decided that the Patricias would become an airborne battalion. We would have a airborne battalion. Patricia's would be it. And so the SAS company was disbanded, and I returned to the Patricia's. And we started sending serials from the Patricia's. And about this time, I got a shot at 6 months at the U.S. Marine Corps Amphibious Warfare School in Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. And I took a platoon of hand-picked soldiers from the PPCLI to it. Had a grand time, super time. We were the best troops they'd ever seen, by far.
Really?
They still remember us. When the Commandant, General Shoup from the Marine Corps, arrived to inspect Camp Lejeune, he was shocked to find that the Guard of Honor was provided not by the United States Marine Corps, but by 1st Battalion PPCLI. That's some kind of a shock scene. All these airborne soldiers with their cherry berries and their camp smocks and their jump boots and everything. Anyway. And then back to regimental duty. And exercises, airborne exercises, Sweetbriar, the North Country, the Arctic. And then in June of 50, the North Koreans crossed the 38th parallel and we had trouble again. And it was decided at that time to raise a special force to fight in a Canadian brigade in Korea. And so they raised 2nd battalions of the original battalions. By this time, all the other battalions were airborne. They decided to have an airborne brigade instead of a battalion, of a regiment. So there was great hooing and hawing. Nobody wanted to be left behind. After all, we were the seniors and we should have gone first. But that didn't make any cut any ice. We detached certain officers and certain senior NCOs to the 2nd Battalion to help provide them with some professional expertise. They brought people back into the service like Colonel Stone with his 2 DSOs and his MC and his 3 MIDs to command the 2nd Battalion. Best infantry commander in the Canadian Army in perhaps the last 50 years, as a matter of fact, Colonel Stone. And off they went to Korea. And the 2nd battalions of the original regiments. And we waved them goodbye, and then we relieved them. I arrived in Korea in September 51. They didn't get to Korea. They did about 10 months in Korea, but a very first-class 10 months. They won a United States presidential citation, the first Canadian unit, the only Canadian unit that's ever won such a thing. And we took over from them in Korea. And at that time, I was adjutant of the 1st Battalion PPCLI. And you generally do that for a year, and then you either get posted or promoted or somebody can come with you. So I finished my tour as adjutant. I did the move for the battalion. I finished my tour as adjutant, and then I was posted to deacon of the churches, and I commanded it for the next year in Korea. And a little different commanding a rifle company with 3 platoons rather than commanding a platoon with 3 sections.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very much like what I've always imagined World War I was like. Lots of patrolling,